Hello, this is Ed Reedy from the Talking Information Center with the Wednesday, February 18th reading of Newsweek magazine. Tom Homan refutes claims that ICE is racial profiling. By Peter Aitken. Border Czar Tom Homan on Sunday defended Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE agents, against accusations of racial profiling, which Democrats have alleged as part of their raft of reforms necessary to pass Department of Homeland Security, DHS, funding. They want to stop racial profiling. That's just not occurring, Homan said during an appearance on CBS News' Face the Nation. ICE will detain briefly to question somebody based on reasonable suspicion. Has nothing to do with racial profile. He added, I'll let the White House and the members of Congress fight that out, but I think some of these asks are just unreasonable because there is no racial profile. There is identifying marks. Why it matters, the tactics ICE has employed as part of the Trump administration's immigration enforcement operation have drawn sharp scrutiny after multiple U.S. citizens and legally present immigrants said they were detained or questioned during operations. Civil rights groups and local officials have argued these tactics have disproportionately targeted Latino, Somali, and other minority communities. Fueling allegations of racial profiling, the administration has repeatedly denied in court filings. Federal judges initially pushed back with a district court in Los Angeles ruling ICE had unlawfully detained people based on factors such as apparent race or ethnicity, accent, job type, or location. But the Supreme Court ultimately intervened and lifted those restrictions. However, lawmakers have demanded reforms to ICE and Customs and Border Patrol, CBP, operations after Nicole Good and Alex Preddy, two Americans, were fatally shot by federal agents during a fraught and often chaotic operation in Minnesota in January. Homan ultimately intervened in that operation to cool tempers and effectuate a substantial drawdown of the federal presence in the state. What to know? Congressional Democrats successfully negotiated with the White House and Republican counterparts to split out DHS funding from a larger funding bill last month as part of an effort to avoid another prolonged government shutdown. The agreement provided 2 weeks of a continuing resolution, CR, of funding for the DHS based on the most recently approved budget, while lawmakers debated reforms, which Democrats have prioritized in order to support any further funding. Those reforms include mandatory body cameras, standardized uniforms, a ban on masks, and an end to racial profiling, and requiring agents to show ID upon request and to have a judicial warrant to enter any private property. The administration and Republican lawmakers have pushed back against some of those measures, even as others, as House Speaker Mike Johnson, a Louisiana Republican, recently said, are obviously reasonable and should happen, adding that others are going to require a lot more negotiation. Homan made clear he is not part of reform negotiations, but said while he doesn't like such elements as face masks worn by officers, there remain concerns of threats against federal officers, citing a figure that such threats have increased up over 1,500%, while actual assaults have also increased by a similar margin. These men and women have to protect themselves, Homan said Sunday. As far as identifying themselves, they all have placards. They identify themselves as ICE, HSI, DEA, FBI, so they all have placards on them. So I'll let the White House and the members of Congress fight that out. He added that while he insists there isn't racial profiling taking place, that if lawmakers passed legislation that banned doxing agents or something like that, he would support prohibiting face masks and other measures, citing previous laws already in place against injuring, harming, or threatening federal authorities in the course of carrying out their duties. What people are saying, Representative John Garamendi, California Democrat, said in a statement last week, Congress needs to pass the Freeze ICE Act to impose a hiring freeze at ICE and put proper accountability measures and procedural reforms in place to ensure the safety of Americans. I am gravely concerned about the steps Trump has taken to try and turn ICE into a secret police force, something that should never happen here in America. House Speaker Mike Johnson, a Louisiana Republican, wrote on X on Saturday, "Here we go again, the new Democratic shutdown, this time of the Department of Homeland Security. We'll hit some very important programs like FEMA disaster response, TSA security lines, and Coast Guard operations. That means delayed disaster aid, airport chaos, and weakened law enforcement. Democrats are once again risking public safety just to stage a pointless political stunt." Assistant Secretary of Homeland Security Tricia McLaughlin previously told Newsweek, "This funding supports national security and critical national emergency operations, including FEMA, responses to a historic snowstorm that is affecting 250 million Americans. Washington may stall, but the safety of the American people will not wait." Trump administration sends letter accusing Green Massey of being in Epstein files, by Holly Silverman. Department of Justice sent a six-page letter to Congress on Saturday explaining redactions that were made in the Jeffrey Epstein files and listed government officials and politically exposed persons referenced in them, prompting immediate pushback from lawmakers who have led efforts to force a full disclosure. Listed in the letter, among many others, included former Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Georgia Republican, Representative Nancy Mace, a South Carolina Republican, Representative Thomas Massie, a Kentucky Republican, and Representative Ro Khanna, California Democrat. Why it matters. Multiple prominent figures in various industries have been named in a series of released documents related to Epstein, a convicted sex offender and financier. Earlier this year, the DOJ published more than 3 million pages of material under the Epstein Files Transparency Act, which was spearheaded by Massey and Khanna and signed into law by President Donald Trump in November. The tranche of documents includes 2,000 videos and 180,000 images, making the total production nearly 3.5 million pages released in compliance with the Act. Appearing in the Epstein files is not indicative of criminal wrongdoing, and there haven't been any arrests or charges filed against those named. Epstein died by suicide in a New York jail in 2019 while awaiting sex trafficking charges. The dispute over the scope and transparency of the files, as well as the Trump administration, has intensified after the DOJ's letter claimed a full release while also describing redactions and listing high-profile figures referenced in the files. In their letter, Attorney General Pam Bondi and Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche told Congress the department released all records, documents, communications, and investigative material in the possession of the department that relate to Epstein. The DOJ letter appended a list of prominent people referenced in the files, including President Donald Trump, former Presidents Joe Biden and Barack Obama, former Vice President Kamala Harris, Tucker Carlson, Bruce Springsteen, Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, Robert De Niro, Barbara Streisand, Elon Musk, Bill Gates, Richard Branson, Katherine Ruemmler, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, and Steve Tisch, among many others. Green, Mace, and Khanna and Massey react. Green, who signed a discharge petition to force a House vote on releasing the Epstein files, wrote on X on Saturday evening that Bondi and Blanche sent a letter to Congress naming tons of people in the Epstein files, adding that some names don't make sense, like Janis Joplin, who died in 1970, and all kinds of politicians, including those of us who fought the hardest to release the files, like me, Thomas Massie, Ro Khanna, and Nancy Mace. The former congresswoman continued, supposedly Jeffrey Epstein committed suicide in 2019. I ran for Congress in 2020 and became a member of Congress in 2021. My mentions in the files are basically stories unrelated to Epstein, like me criticizing COVID mask rules and COVID vaccine passports. Why are stories about my refusal to comply with COVID tyranny and other news stories unrelated to Epstein about me listed in the Epstein files? What kind of files are the FBI and DOJ keeping on us? What is actually going on? Mace, who also signed a discharge petition to force a House vote on releasing the files, weighed in on the letter, criticizing the DOJ's legal rationale. Despite the memo released by DOJ last night, not all the Epstein files have been released, and the excuses provided for not releasing all the files will not hold up in a court of law. This isn't going away until people go to jail, the congresswoman wrote on X. In another post, Mace wrote, if the DOJ isn't going to do their job and arrest predators, then we will do their job for them. If in this case the closest we can get to justice for the victims is shaming these people out of civil society and out of existence, then that's what we're going to do. Hold the line. Khanna wrote in a September X post that the Justice Department is once again purposefully muddying the waters on who was a predator and who was mentioned in an email. He added, to have Janis Joplin, who died when Epstein was 17, in the same list as Larry Nassar, who went to prison for the sexual abuse of hundreds of young women and child pornography, with no clarification of how either was mentioned in the files, is absurd. Release the full files, stop protecting predators, redact only the survivors' names. Massie, an outlier in his party and a critic of Trump, appeared on ABC News this week on Sunday and said Donald Trump told us that even though he had dinner with these kinds of people in New York City and West Palm Beach, that he would be transparent. But he's not. He's still in with the Epstein class. This is the Epstein administration, and they're attacking me for trying to get these files released. What happens next? Republican lawmakers who pushed for transparency signaled they will continue to scrutinize DOJ's redactions and the completeness of the release. It remains unclear whether Congress will seek additional documentation from DOJ or request unredacted materials. Hillary Clinton says migration has been disruptive and destabilizing. By Ellie Cook. Migration in the United States has become disruptive and destabilizing, Hillary Clinton has said, as protests against federal immigration raids across the country continue. There is a legitimate reason to have a debate about things like migration, the former U.S. Secretary of State and First Lady said during an appearance at the Munich Security Conference in Germany on Saturday. Clinton said it needs to be fixed in a humane way, with secure borders that don't torture and kill people. Clinton has previously described herself as a staunch advocate of comprehensive immigration reform, but said changes to the system should be true to our values in the U.S. Shameful border policy. During President Donald Trump's first term in office, Clinton said the Republican had made it worse with cruel abuses at the border, detaining children and separating them from their families. It's one of the most shameful moments in our history, Clinton said in late 2018. She called for immigration reform and laws to be enforced with fairness and respect for human rights, but said borders could not be open when trying to combat right-wing populism and authoritarianism. Protests have rippled through the U.S. against Trump's immigration crackdown and the actions of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE officers, in often Democratic-led cities across the country. Two U.S. citizens, Renee Nicole Good and Alex Preddy, were actually shot by federal immigration agents last month in Minneapolis, further fueling demonstrations, clashes in the streets, friction with local officials, and attracting closer scrutiny of the power of law enforcement agencies. Roughly 3 in 5 adults now believe the White House has gone too far with its uncompromising campaign against illegal immigration and federal footprint in U.S. cities, a poll by the Associated Press and the NORC, Center for Public Affairs Research, found earlier this month. Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, said on Thursday that the additional presence of immigration agents in Minnesota, known as Operation Metro Surge, would end because it had yielded the successful results the White House had sought. "The state is safer than before," Homan told reporters. The Department of Homeland Security, DHS, which oversees ICE, said earlier in February that immigration officers had made approximately 4,000 arrests in Minnesota since early December. The government did not provide a detailed breakdown beyond saying those arrested included people convicted of sexual conduct with a minor, domestic assault, and assault. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz said it was good news that Metro Surge was coming to a close, but said the flood of immigration agents to the state had damaged the local economy and set its residents on a long road to recovery. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey said on Saturday Operation Metro Surge had cost more than $47 million in lost wages and left more than 8,700 children needing mental health support. Former Democratic President Barack Obama, speaking on a podcast episode released on Saturday, called ICE operations in the Twin Cities area unprecedented, and he publicly offered his support for demonstrators in Minnesota. "It is important for us to recognize the unprecedented nature of what ICE was doing in Minneapolis-St. Paul, the way that federal agents, ICE agents, were being deployed without any clear guidelines, training, pulling people out of their homes," Obama said, "using 5-year-olds to try to bait their parents, all the stuff that we saw, tear-gassing crowds simply who were standing there, not breaking any laws." Hillary Clinton discusses Epstein at Munich conference. Former Secretary of State described recently released documents, images, and videos in the so-called Jeffrey Epstein files as very troubling and really horrific information during her appearance at the annual Defense and Security Conference in Germany. The Department of Justice, DOJ, published more than 3 million new pages relating to the late convicted pedophile and disgraced financier on January 30. An act signed into law by Trump last year obligates the DOJ to publish all unclassified records, documents, communications, and investigative materials held by the department relating to Epstein, his associate Ghislaine Maxwell, as well as several other criteria, like internal departmental memos discussing Epstein and his associates. Appearing in the Epstein files is not an indication of wrongdoing, but the vast trove of often uncontextualized information, including email exchanges involving Epstein, have proved highly embarrassing for a litany of prominent individuals, from business leaders to politicians and royals. Clinton was asked by a reporter on Saturday how the alleged actions of Western leaders mentioned in the files matches up with shared values in the Western world, according to CNN. She then reportedly responded, "It's horrifying, and we're hoping that, you know, there will be continued release every day that passes." Clinton and her husband, former U.S. President Bill Clinton, have said they will testify to lawmakers as part of a congressional investigation into Epstein, avoiding being found in contempt of Congress for not complying with subpoenas. The Clintons had argued the subpoenas were legally invalid. The former Secretary of State will appear before the House Budget Oversight Committee for a deposition on February 26. Former President Clinton had a publicly documented friendship with Epstein decades ago and appears several times in the Epstein files, but has not been accused of wrongdoing. VA announces change to veteran benefits. By Amanda Greenwood. The Department of Veterans Affairs, VA, has finalized a new rule that it says is designed to streamline certain decisions around veteran survivors' benefit claims. A move the agency says will result in faster decisions and quicker payments for survivors. The VA's new survivor benefit rule, previously under existing regulations, the VA had to individually process survivor claims for dependency and indemnity compensation, DIC, and survivor's pension. This often slowed decisions because each benefit required a separate formal review. Under the new rule, which will be effective from February 23rd, the VA will pay a surviving spouse or child claimant, whichever benefit is higher, either the DIC or the survivor's pension. The agency says the higher benefit is usually the DIC without delaying payment to fully process the lesser amount. The VA identified one exception. If the claimant is the veteran's surviving spouse, has no dependents, is residing in a nursing home, and has applied for or is receiving Medicaid, then the survivor's pension will be awarded instead of DIC. Under the new rule, when surviving spouse stops Medicaid-covered nursing home care, DIC may become effective as of the date Medicaid coverage ended, if a claim is filed within 1 year. Conversely, if a spouse receiving DIC begins Medicaid-covered nursing home care and otherwise qualifies for survivor's pension, the pension may take effect on the first day of the month after DIC ends, provided a claim is filed within 1 year. VA Secretary Doug Collins said this common-sense change streamlines the survivor's claims process, reduces administrative burdens, and delivers quicker decisions to beneficiaries during challenging times. For questions or help and support with the new regulation, the VA advises survivors call the VA benefits hotline at 800-827-1000 or email the media to the Office of the Media Relations at vapublicaffairs@va.gov. The difference between a DIC and a standard pension. The VA says DIC is a tax-free monthly benefit that is paid to eligible surviving spouses, children, and parents of service members who died in the line of duty, or veterans whose death resulted from service-related conditions. Survivor's pension, by contrast, provides tax-free monthly payments to qualifying surviving spouses and unmarried dependent children of wartime veterans who meet specific income and net worth limits. What happens next? The new regulation follows a broader survivor's benefit reform effort, which was launched in 2025 and included a three-pronged approach to eliminate barriers and streamline the process for how eligible survivors and dependents of deceased veterans and service members apply for and receive VA benefits and services. This involved moving the Office of Survivors Assistance into the office of the VA Secretary, creating a specialized white glove outreach team to guide survivors through the DIC claims process, and identifying areas for automation to make the claims process quicker and easier for survivors. Colin said the last thing survivors need in their time of grief is frustrating red tape and bureaucracy. That's why we are creating a better system to more quickly and effectively provide survivors the services, support, and compassion they've earned. IRS issues new spike advice for 2026 filing season. By Jasmine Laws. As President's Day draws nearer, the Internal Revenue Service, IRS, has warned taxpayers of a surge in call center demand, as the week is historically one of the busiest periods of the filing season. To avoid long waiting times amid the expected phone traffic next week, Americans are advised to utilize the online tools available to get the answers to various questions. Why it matters. This year's tax filing system season is already set to be busier than last year's, when the IRS announced the start of the tax season on January 26, 2026. It said it expected to receive about 164 million individual income tax returns this year, with most taxpayers filing electronically. Last year, the agency said it expected more than 140 million individual tax year 2024 returns by the deadline of April 15th. What to know? The IRS encouraged taxpayers to start at the Let Us Help You page on IRS.gov to find online tools covering refunds, amended returns, payments, notices, identity verification, and more, which is available 24/7. Through an IRS individual online account, taxpayers can view adjusted gross income and transcripts, enroll in or retrieve an IP PIN, and make or cancel payments. The IRS reiterated that filing electronically and selecting direct deposit is the fastest and safest way to receive a refund, noting that electronic payments are far less likely to be lost, stolen, altered, or delayed compared with paper checks. Under Executive Order 14247, the Treasury Department began phasing out paper tax refund checks on September 30, 2025. The Interactive Tax Assistance also provides answers to common tax questions, including filing status, taxable income, and credit eligibility, and taxpayers can also visit One Big Beautiful Bill provisions for guidance on recent tax law, changes affecting credits and deductions. Taxpayers can track refunds using Where's My Refund, which updates once daily and generally provides status within 24 hours of the IRS accepting an e-filed current year return, with early earned income tax credit and additional child tax credit. Filers typically see updates by February 21. Qualified taxpayers needing additional help can also find no-cost basic tax return preparation from IRS-certified volunteers through Volunteer Income Tax Assistance and Tax Counseling for the Elderly programs. The website also has pages offering tips for choosing a tax preparer and how to avoid unethical ghost return preparers. What people are saying. IRS said with the 2026 filing season underway and increased call center demand around the President's Day holiday on February 16th, the Internal Revenue Service encourages taxpayers to visit Let Us Help You on IRS.gov and use online tools to get fast, convenient help without waiting on hold. President's Day week is historically one of the busiest periods of the filing season, when calls to IRS phone lines often spike. Many common tax questions and tasks can be handled online before, during, and after filing through IRS self-service tools available 24/7. Shipwreck hunters solve a 150-year mystery of disaster that killed eight. By Adelaide Addison. shipwreck hunters have discovered the remains of the Lac La Belle, a luxury steamer that sank in Lake Michigan gale in 1872, killing 8 people, the Associated Press reported. Shipwreck World announced Friday that a team led by Illinois shipwreck hunter Paul Ahorn found the vessel about 20 miles offshore between Racine and Kenosha, Wisconsin, in October 2022. The announcement was delayed to allow the team to create a 3-dimensional video model of the ship, which poor weather and scheduling conflicts prevented until last summer. Why it matters. The discovery completes a nearly 60-year quest by Ahorn, who has been searching for the Lac La Belle since 1965. The finding adds to the historical record of Great Lakes maritime disasters and represents the 15th shipwreck Ahorn has located. The Great Lakes are home to an estimated 6,000 to 10,000 shipwrecks, most of which remain undiscovered, according to the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Wisconsin Water Library. Shipwreck hunters have intensified their searches in recent years due to concerns that invasive quagga mussels are slowly destroying these underwater historical sites. The ship was raised in 1869 and reconditioned before returning to service. On the night of October 13, 1872, the ship left Milwaukee for Grand Haven, Michigan, carrying 53 passengers and crew, along with cargo including barley, pork, flour, and whiskey. About 2 hours into the journey, during a severe gale, the ship began leaking uncontrollably. The captain turned back toward Milwaukee, but massive waves crashed over the vessel, extinguishing the boilers. Around 5 a.m., as the storm drove the ship southward, the captain ordered lifeboats lowered, and the Lac La Belle went down stern first. One lifeboat capsized on the way to shore, killing 8 people. The other lifeboat successfully reached land along the Wisconsin coast between Racine and Kenosha. Ahorn, now 80, used a clue from fellow wreck hunter and author Ross Richardson in 2022 to narrow his search area. Using side-scan sonar, he located the ship after just 2 hours on the lake. The wreck's exterior is covered with quagga mussels, and the upper cabins are gone, but the hull appears intact and the oak interiors remain in good condition. What people are saying, Paul Ahorn told the Associated Press, it's kind of a game, like solve the puzzle. Sometimes you don't have many pieces to put the puzzle together, but this one worked out and we found it right away. It's getting harder and harder. The easier ones have been found. The Scuba News on X, lost in 1872, found nearly 150 years later, the passenger steamer Lac La Belle has finally been discovered in Lake Michigan by veteran wreck hunter Paul Ahorn, and the story behind it reads like pure maritime legend. USPS announces new forever stamp. By Amanda Greenwood, the U.S. Postal Service, USPS, has unveiled and announced the launch of 4 new forever stamps to honor the quilt maker Harriet Powers, whose narrative creations have been recognized as American folk art and storytelling, according to a USPS national release. The new Harriet Powers Forever stamps, the new stamps feature 4 different scenes from Harriet Powers' 1898 pictorial quilt, which she created between 1895 and 1898, and which currently resides at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, according to the Art History Project. The quilt is made up of 3 rows of 5 panels, with each panel depicting narrative scenes drawn from biblical stories, historical events, and folklore, including Adam and Eve, Jonah and the whale, and the angels of wrath from the Book of Revelation. The USPS didn't release specific details about which 4 panels are featured in the Forever Stamp collection, but said that the service's art director, dairy noise, chose details that would hold up well at stamp size and still communicate the stories Powers was trying to tell, looking for variety and color combinations that worked well together. Noise arranged the four designs so that their starting position shifts by row, creating the impression of more than four scenes across the pane, telling USPS that she wanted the pane to look as if it were more than just four different scenes. By changing the starting order at the beginning of each row, I was able to create the impression of a multitude of scenes. Powers, born into slavery near Athens, Georgia, in 1837, created at least five quilts, including two story quilts, one called the Bible quilt and the other the pictorial quilt, both of which reflect biblical narratives and local lore. According to the USPS release, Powers entered the Bible quilt into a local fair competition, and an art teacher, who went on to eventually buy the quilt, displayed it in the International Exposition in Atlanta, where some Atlanta University faculty wives saw it and commissioned Powers to create a new quilt, the pictorial quilt, as a gift for the vice president of the university board, Charles Cuthbert Hall. It remained in the Hall family for 62 years. Harriet Powers Forever Stamp Availability. The USPS announced that the first day of issue ceremony will be held on February 28, 2026 in Washington, D.C., in conjunction with the Association for the Study of African American Life and History's Black History Month celebration, and that the event will be free and open to the public. The stamps will be issued in panes of 20, and customers will be able to purchase them online by phone, by mail, or at post office locations nationwide beginning February 28th. Forever stamps will always be equal to the current first-class mail 1-ounce price, meaning they can be used without additional postage, even if prices increase after purchase. Other 2026 Forever Stamps. USPS has recently announced other 2026 Forever Stamp releases, including the Lowriders Collection, which the agency reported would debut March 13th in San Diego as a set of five stamps, featuring classic customized cars, and the Lunar New Year, Year of the Horse Forever Stamp, featuring a three-dimensional paper-cut mask by artist Camille Chu. Who is Scott Socia? Trump's new national parks nomination sparks backlash. By Jasmine Laws. President Donald Trump has nominated hospitality executive Scott Socia to be director of the National Park Service, NPS, a move that has been met with public backlash. Socia is president for Parks and Resorts at Delaware North, a company that once sued to claim trademark rights to the Yosemite name. The NPS has been without an official director for more than a year, and Wednesday's nomination follows widespread layoffs within the NPS as part of the Trump administration's efforts to reduce its size. The Department of the Interior, DOI, told Newsweek the president has nominated highly qualified individuals to serve in key roles across the Department of the Interior. We respect the president's authority to select leaders who will advance his agenda and serve the American people. We look forward to working with those who are confirmed by the Senate to support Interior's mission. Why it matters. Over the past year, the Trump administration has implemented a number of changes in regard to the country's national parks, changes that have been met with a mixed response. Some people have expressed concerns about how America's national parks are being changed, such as the removal of Martin Luther King Jr. Day and Juneteenth from the 2026 National Parks Fee-Free Days, prompting lawmakers to raise legislation to counter the move. The new digital America the Beautiful passes with the president's face on them have also been unpopular with some, sparking a lawsuit. It was also announced those who covered Trump's face could find their pass voided. Under the direction of Trump's executive order, Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History, the NPS has also been flagging various exhibitions and signs for review, particularly those about climate change, sea level rise, LGBTQ rights, slavery, and racism. Some have already been removed, which has sparked notable backlash. That said, there has been support for national park reform, including the lower costs offered to Americans through the America First pricing model and the administration's focus on celebrating American patriotism. Who is Scott Socia? In his work at Delaware North, Socia provides strategic direction and ensures that short and long-term plans are in place to drive business and enhance the company's destination properties, according to the company's website. Prior to working as president for Parks and Resorts and Delaware North, Australia, Socia served as Delaware North vice president and the company's treasurer. As treasurer, he oversaw Delaware's North Financial Planning and Analysis, Treasury and Risk Management Groups. Socia has been with the company since 1999 and will continue in his role there while his nomination is pending, company spokesperson told the Associated Press. Delaware North describes itself as one of the world's largest privately owned hospitality and entertainment companies, with more than $4 billion in revenue in 2022. It provides hospitality services in at least six national parks, including Grand Canyon, Yellowstone, and Shenandoah. In 2016, after the company lost a $2 billion bid to renew its contract to continue operating Yosemite's hotels and restaurants to competitor Aramark, Delaware North sued, claiming it had intellectual property rights to various names used at the park worth more than $50 million, including Yosemite National Park, Awnee Hotel, and Curry Village. The landmarks were briefly renamed. Awnee Hotel became the Majestic Yosemite Hotel, and Curry Village branded as Half Dome Village, but in 2019 the lawsuit was settled. White House spokesperson Taylor Rogers and Socia said Socia was totally qualified to execute Trump's plans for the park system, according to the Associated Press. Scott looks forward to implementing America First initiatives, such as increasing park access for American families, reducing permitting burdens, and raising money for conservation projects, Rogers said. The Bernhardt Group, an advisory firm set up by former U.S. Secretary of the Interior David Bernhardt in 2025, consists of bipartisan leaders, including officials from Trump's first term, also congratulated Socia on his nomination and applauded the Trump administration. Scott is an outstanding choice to lead the charge in preserving America's natural and cultural treasures, the group wrote in a post on X. He has dedicated his career to environmental stewardship while strengthening the gateway communities that support and sustain our national parks. We commend the Trump administration for recognizing Scott's leadership and proven track record through his nomination. The National Parks Conservation Association has said it's ready to work with Socia after Wednesday's nomination. Teresa Pierno, president and CEO for the association, said in a statement, "Our national parks need strong, sensible leadership now more than ever before. Given Mr. Socia's years of experience working with the Park Service, we hope he will be that leader." However, others have been less supportive of the nomination. Environmentalists like Brett Hartle, government affairs director at the Center for Biological Diversity, told the news outlet SFGate, "The parks are not about making money for the hotel industry. The goal of parks is to protect them so they can be enjoyed by all Americans, now and into the future. That's the mission of the parks. It's not to maximize profits of a few companies," he added. Jason O'Neill, spokesperson for Save Our Parks, a campaign fighting to save America's parks and public lands, which does not support the Trump administration's policies, said in a statement on Thursday, The private park concessionaire executive, Socha, has zero experience in public service or conservation. Aaron Weiss, deputy director of the Center for Western Priorities, a nonpartisan conservation advocacy group, said in a statement, Scott Socha was all in on the Trump administration's park privatization efforts last time around, even sitting at the table with the Interior Secretary and a corrupt congressman. Now, President Trump and Secretary Burgum want to give him another bite at the apple, taking over an agency that has been decimated by DOGE and is under increasing pressure to whitewash and rewrite American history. Senators must approach this nomination with the utmost skepticism given Scott Socha's history and the current state of our national parks. Members of the public have also taken to social media platforms to voice their concern over the nomination. One user wrote, "Here comes the McDonaldization of the national parks. The GOP has wanted to privatize them for decades." What happens next? Following the president's nomination, the Senate must confirm it before Socha can take up the role. This involves various types of investigation and review, as well as a Senate vote. Ex-Prince Andrew asked Epstein to help secure $200 million for U.S. military vendor. By Jack Royston. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor passed on to Jeffrey Epstein a request for help securing $200 million to finance supplying the U.S. Department of Defense with fuel. Emails from the Epstein files appear to show. A managing partner for Concord Investment Partners Holdings seems to have approached Mountbatten Windsor, formerly Prince Andrew, by email, asking for an introduction to a senior banker at either Barclays or RBS in September 2010. The stated reason was to secure $200 million for a company named as Area Petroleum that he said needed the money to fund significantly increased business from the U.S. Department of Defense. The Concord email said Area was the preferred vendor of U.S. DOD defense logistics. Andrew's Royal Household Aide, then Private Secretary Amanda Thirsk, was CC'd into this initial email. 3 months later, Mountbatten Windsor appears to have forwarded the message to Jeffrey Epstein on December 2, 2010. This was during the same month he traveled to New York to stay at Epstein's house and was photographed walking through Central Park by paparazzi. Mountbatten Windsor would later tell the BBC the trip was organized to formally break off contact with Epstein in person, which he described as the honorable thing to do. Thirsk was not CC'd into the message to Epstein. Newsweek approached Buckingham Palace former representatives of Mountbatten Windsor and Thirsk for comment. A business named Area Petroleum UK Limited was listed in Britain in 2012, and filings seen by Newsweek show it was part controlled by Gunvor, a company the U.S. Treasury in November last year said was a Kremlin puppet. Mountbatten Windsor's email forwarded the request for financing to Epstein, seen by Newsweek, read, "I should have done something about this, but not sure if the office did. I'm checking, but as this is a U.S. institution, do you know of anyone who might like to take a look?" He signed off, HRH, the Duke of York, KG. At the time, Mountbatten Windsor was a U.K. trade envoy. Epstein appears to have forwarded the message to Jess Staley, a friend of his who was head of J.P. Morgan's private bank at the time and who would go on to later be chief executive of Barclays Bank. Epstein's message read simply, FYI, there are no further references to Area Petroleum in the 3 million Epstein-related documents so far published. Newsweek contacted representatives of Staley for comment. Norman Baker, a former Liberal Democratic Member of Parliament who served in the UK government as Transport Minister at the time the emails were exchanged, told Newsweek they should be reviewed by the police. I think there's a need for a general review into all of Andrew's activities as trade envoy, both in terms of propriety and legality, but also more morally, what he was doing and what the impact was on Britain, because he wasn't, in my view, representing Britain, but representing himself, he said. And immediately out of this, what needs to happen is we need to have a clear understanding from him as to whether he got any money out of this, Baker said. He's potentially endangering UK-US relations, potentially aiding and abetting a dodgy Russian, and potentially damaging Britain's credibility on the international landscape. And for all those reasons, we need to be clear what actually happened. He should make a clear statement and answer the question directly as to whether he got commission for this, and if so, how much. Files so far released by the DOJ include emails in which Epstein states that Mountbatten Windsor cannot profit as a royal. At the time of the emails, Andrew was negotiating for Epstein to pay off his ex-wife Sarah Ferguson's debt to a former employee, John O'Sullivan. Other emails in November and December of 2010 show Andrew discussing the debt in the same email chains as trade envoy reports that he passed to Epstein. Why it matters. By the time of these 2010 emails, Epstein had already been convicted of procuring a minor for prostitution after a 2008 plea deal, and served a prison sentence, including a period under house arrest. It is not clear whether Concord's claim about ARIA being the U.S. Department of Defense Logistics' preferred supplier at the time is correct, and indeed BP was named as the biggest supplier in 2009 by the Seattle Times, holding its percentage share into 2010. However, then-President Barack Obama was critical of BP in 2010, alleging recklessness in the major Deepwater Horizon oil spill of April that year. There were indeed active debates about whether America should pivot to other suppliers. Concerns surrounding Mountbatten Windsor's willingness to involve both himself and Epstein in the U.S. military's procurement of fuel at a time when it was still operating in Afghanistan will only increase because of the apparent connection between ARIA and the Kremlin. Who is Jess Staley? Staley is a former U.S. banking executive who served as chief executive of Barclays from 2015 until his resignation in 2021, after a regulatory probe into how he described his past relationship with Epstein. Staley first met Epstein in the late 1990s when Epstein was a client of J.P. Morgan Chase's private bank, which Staley then ran. UK regulators later found the two had a close personal and professional relationship that continued after Epstein's 2008 conviction and into Staley's tenure at Barclays. In 2019, Barclays told regulators that Staley did not have a close relationship with Epstein and that their contact had ended before he joined the bank. But the UK's Financial Conduct Authority refuted this account, citing an email in which Staley described Epstein as my most cherished friend. In 2023, the Financial Conduct Authority banned Staley for life from holding senior roles in the country's financial sector and fined him more than £1 million, a decision upheld by a tribunal in 2025, while Barclays clawed back roughly £18 million in pay and bonuses. Staley has not been criminally charged and denies knowing about Epstein's crimes, though U.S. prosecutors have reviewed but not pursued allegations related to Epstein's associates. Andrew's attempt to meet Staley. filings seen by Newsweek from a New York lawsuit filed by the U.S. Virgin Islands against J.P. Morgan shows Mountbatten-Windsor had hoped to meet Staley the same month he forwarded the message to Epstein in December 2010. Mountbatten-Windsor wrote to Staley on December 22, 2010, wishing you a very happy Christmas and New Year. Sorry to have missed you this week. I had to go to Afghanistan, so couldn't be there and couldn't tell you why or where I was. Hope to catch up sometime after the New Year. I will be at Davos as usual. Andrew visited British troops in Afghanistan on December 19, 2010. Staley replied, "Be safe there. I bet it helps people that you're there. I will get you the schedule of the J.P. Morgan stuff. Rosa, can you send the place and time of the Morgan events in Davos? I must say, getting a Christmas note from the Duke of York is sort of cool. Sorry we missed in London." There is nothing in the emails to indicate what they plan to discuss. Epstein appears to have attempted to set up another meeting between Mountbatten-Windsor and Staley in 2011, writing, "Andrew asked for your London schedule," in an email to Staley at the end of February. It's not clear whether the proposed meeting was about funding Area Petroleum or not. What happens next? The U.S. House Oversight Committee has asked Mountbatten-Windsor to testify. There is not yet any sign he intends to. And that's all the time we have for today. Stay safe and thank you for listening.